My name is Dean, and I too am an alcoholic. And whenever I identify myself as an alcoholic, I base that identification on my interpretation of the definition of the word alcoholic as it's defined in the third chapter of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, wherein it says that we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And that's all it says. Don't make any reference to how much you drank, what you drank, where you drank, or what happened as a result of your drinking. It doesn't say in order to qualify for membership in AA or identify as an alcoholic, you gotta spend your time on Skid Row, drink wine, go to jails and institutions, and marry the same woman three or four times. Those are things that can happen to anybody who drinks, you know. I'm sort of here as a fill-in, and I guess everybody else is making announcements, so I'll give you a couple that you might be interested in. My dear associate and longtime friend Clancy, who was supposed to be here tonight, does not have cancer of the throat, despite any kind of a rumor you might hear. About a month and a half ago, we were away someplace, and he got a chicken bone caught in his throat. And when they were trying to get it out, they scratched the inside of his sternum in there someplace. And because he was going to a throat doctor, you know how AA is. And that's one announcement. And then the other announcement is that he's not in Russia telling the Russians all about AA, you know. That's another little rumor that got started. When Mike called up and told me that Clancy had other commitments and couldn't make it here this year, I was sort of amazed that he asked me to come, because I was here last year, you know, and the only time I've ever been to a place more than once is prison. But here we are, you know, and I love this place. This is a very enchanting place, a little seacoast town like that, And I have said it to members of the committee here today, and I also said it last year, that I wouldn't mind settling in a little place like this and run them dogs on the beach every morning and have some kind of a little business downtown, you know, where I'd have a sign that would say, "Be back in a half an hour." You know? And I could really make it here. I did have a nice ride back from the airport with these two guys, and we cut up a few old touches and found out we had a lot of things in common and done those things that AAs do, tell a couple of jokes, tell a few lies, but we became acquainted, you know, and that bond that we all know so well in AA was formed, of course, you know. I was trying to think of something intelligent here to say tonight, you know, because I was asked by another party here, they said, how do they generally introduce you, you know, they said, "I hear some awful things about you, you know, you're black belt AA and all of that kind of crap, you know." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm probably a bullshitter and a clowner in every area of my life, except this area. This area here is a life and death proposition with me, and I certainly hope it's the same with you. This is no place for fooling around. This is no place for larks. This is no place for any kind of cheap crap." And a guy once introduced me one way, and the way he introduced me is something I've always remembered, you know, because, and I don't tell you this to be egotistical, but I recognized and I identified with what he said when he was talking about me. He was talking first about a little town in Wisconsin, someplace in rural Wisconsin. And he had visited this little town, and he was taken up by the rurality of it, you know, and it was the early fall and the leaves were turning and all them beautiful colors and they were rustling on the ground, you know, and a little nip in the air signifying the oncoming winter. And this guy was just so caught up in that kind of an atmosphere. It was sort of like a real life Hallmark greeting card, you know, and he said he got up early one morning and he wandered down into the town square to just be part of that Wisconsin moment, you know. And he said he was the only one in the square that morning, you know, and it was a typical old rural town, you know, had the little band shelter in the center of the square, and most of the department stores surrounded the bandstand, and he said he was the only one there, and the leaves were rustling along, and the wind was catching them and flipping them around. And he says, right in the middle of this reverie that he was experiencing, he noticed coming down one of the side streets, approaching the square, tapping of a cane, a blind man being led by a seeing-eye dog. And he sort of got caught up in that, you know, watching this dog who was so dedicated to this blind man, you know, this severely handicapped person. And he was totally amazed how the dog would steer him away from bumping into a trash can and kept him from stepping into a little rut in the sidewalk. And when they came to the curving, he knew when to go down and when to come up, and he held him back from the stoplight. And he just was totally enthralled as he watched the blind man and the dog traverse the entire square, you know. And all of a sudden they came to halt right alongside of him where he was standing. And he was just about to make some remark to the blind man about the dog's dedication when all of a sudden the dog lifted up his hind leg and he peed on the blind man. And this guy couldn't understand that, you know. And he was about to admonish the dog, but before he had a chance to, the blind man reached into his pocket and got a couple of pieces of candy, and he reached down and he gave them to the dog. Well, he couldn't handle that. So he tapped the blind man on the shoulder, and he told him, he says, I don't understand this. He says, don't you know what that dog just did to you? And the blind man says, yes, he peed on my leg. And he says, then what the hell are you giving him candy for? And the blind man said, I'm trying to find his mouth so I can kick his ass. And that's about how I work with alcoholics, you know. I'm not a tough guy, but I come from that school called tough love. I believe in that tough love, you know. And I believe it's the only way to save an alcoholic, you know, is to be firm and tough. I was always told that the sign of a good sponsor is someone you hate. And that's true, because the sponsor, if he's doing his job, is generally telling you things you don't want to hear. He's making you do things you don't want to do. And I certainly used to light candles in any kind of a church I could come to for my sponsor's death. I wish he'd die all the time. You know. But he didn't, and he lived. You know, I don't know why I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to try desperately not to continue on in any kind of a recourse of what I was talking about the last time I was here. If I hadn't been so cheap, I would have bought one of them tapes, and then I could have played it, I guess. But I don't know what the hell I talked about, so I've been sort of sneaking about, you know. Somebody said, oh, I heard you last year, and I said, yeah, what did I talk about? You know? And so I've sort of picked up on a few things that I won't dwell on too much this evening. But after all, you know, you only got one story. You only got here one way. And the way I got here is probably no different than the way you got here, only it was in a different place at a different time. But it certainly was for the same reason. There came a time in my life, like in your life, alcohol became the most important thing in my life, and it was my life. I never meant it to be that way. It was no great dream I had. It wasn't a goal of mine to become an alcoholic. But it came about. It came about. It came about in a common way, you know. I don't think I'm a unique alcoholic. I don't think I'm any more spectacular than anybody else or any less spectacular than anybody else. I believe I'm just one of the guys, you know, one of the guys. And I used to try to pinpoint the time that it happened and when I crossed over that invisible line. I don't know if it was when I went into the Marines at age 16. I don't know if it was when I was in high school. I really don't know when it was. But I think there's a lot of things that take place prior to probably even our alcoholic nature that are the beginning of the development of an alcoholic personality, of a personality that's eventually going to arrive at a point in our life that's described so well in this book as an illusion, you know, an illusion that somehow, some way, someday, I'll once more be able to drink and enjoy my drinking, you know. Alcohol did become very important to me. And Like you, I risked my life to get it. I forfeited everything I ever owned and loved dearly for it, because that time did come. And I'm quite sure the time had come in many of the lives of you sitting in this room tonight, that it was important. I know that I'm not the only person in this room who at one time or another back in your drinking career, at sometime at its lowest moment, at its most hopeless time, you didn't grasp your head, you know, and say, Jesus Christ, give me a drink before I die, you know. And believe that you were going to die. Because I thought I was going to die. I spent a period of my life, you know, on Chicago Skid Row, West Madison Street, and living a 20-minute interval. That was the length of my life, you know, from one drink to the next, you know. I knew if I got a drink, I could last for another 20 minutes. As soon as I got the drink, my only concern was, would I get another one 20 minutes from now? Because if I didn't, surely I'd die. And a lot of people, the normal type people, find that kind of philosophy hard to accept. They say, for Christ's sake, how can it get that important? How can it get that important? And that's because they don't understand you and I. They don't understand us, them so-called normal people. At least most of them don't, you know. There are some dedicated professionals now who work within the field of alcoholism, who by efforts generated on their own part have come to understand us a lot better than it used to be. It used to be. But it's still, you know, we're caught in a hell of a fix here in alcoholism. Let me just point out something. This really has nothing to do with AA, but I spoke at a non-AA thing Wednesday, a medical association, and I brought this up, and I got them all rattled up now, and they're writing me nasty letters, and they're going to sue me and all of that. And, you know, and I spoke spontaneously. I never have prepared any kind of a talk in my life. I'm just a big mouth that just shoots off whatever the hell comes out, you know. And I was sort of hot that afternoon at these guys and doctors, you know. And I said, you know what upsets me about you doctors, you know. And there was about maybe 300-400 of them sitting there. I said, in 1957, you had the audacity and the braggadocio to come on out and say, alcoholism is a disease. Big goddamn deal, right? They named it a disease, but they wouldn't let us in their hospitals. They wouldn't let us get covered with medical insurance. And whenever we got caught with the disease, they put us in jail. That's how it was in 1957. And then I said, and on top of that, I says, any ethical doctor, and I challenged every one of them sitting in the audience, and you can do the same with your own private physician, if you may. Ask any ethical doctor that'll have the courage to answer you honestly. How many hours did you spend in your medical training on alcoholism? And I dare say the average will come out to less than 8. 8 hours. Yet the American Medical Association has proudly announced that the number one health problem in the world today is alcoholism. And the guys that are charged with the responsibility of taking care of it don't know nothing about it. And you don't think we're in trouble? Holy gee. Thank God for AA, you know. Thank God for AA. And I'm sorry. I apologize ahead of time for getting off on a subject like that. I really shouldn't be talking about things like that here because we're not... No, that's true. That's true. You know, we're not supposed to get involved in any kind of controversy. But you probably realize now I'm searching for something to talk about. See, that's what I'm really doing, you know. It's nice to be here with Angie and Jim, old friends of mine. And Shirley was wonderful. You know, you got Sean and his lovely wife here. So you're really in for a hell of a weekend, and I know you'll enjoy Jim from Texas tomorrow, if you don't lie, you know. He's from Texas, so you gotta watch out for them, you know. They everything is big in Texas. Even their lies are big in Texas. But that day that I think I became an alcoholic, you know, if it's important to know, might have come about. I'm a stonemason by trade. I'm retired, of course. Haven't been active in the construction business for years. But I was indentured as a small boy to my grandfather, and I became a stonemason, and that's the only kind of work I've ever done and ever really have known how to do. Those of you who were here last year know I don't have an education. Me and education just never got along. I come from the Mark Twain school of education, you know. Mark Twain always said he never let schooling interfere with his education, and that's about how I am, you know. I'm a street kid, born and raised in the Lower East Side of New York City, and I'm a survivor. I'm a survivor. I've never known serenity in my life. You know, I don't know what the hell it is. I've scrapped and scrabbled all my damn life for whatever the hell I had, good or bad, good or bad. And I could have used that as an excuse for being an alcoholic. But for Christ's sake, I'm not the only kid that ever came out of Hell's Kitchen, you know, and went on to great things without any problem with alcohol. So I stopped really searching for the reason, the nature, the cause, or whatever the hell you want to call it. It's like that cartoon you see around sometimes of the five guys standing around the quicksand pit. And half submerged in the quicksand pit is a jackass, you know. And they're all standing around there talking, trying to figure out how the jackass got in there. And meanwhile, a jackass is going down deeper and deeper. The problem isn't how you got in, the problem is how you got out. And that's what's important to me, how I got out, you know. Like you, I have to make a decision every day, and I'll make that decision for the rest of my life. How I choose to live today, with or without a drink. That's the only problem I've got in this world today. Getting through today without taking a drink. Now, the day that I lost that control might possibly have been this kind of a day. I was building the company that I worked for was building a shopping center sort of a deal in a place called Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I was the masonry foreman on that job, and I lived in a small town in northern Illinois. So I was away from home all week long, would stay up in Milwaukee, and then on the weekends I'd come home to the family, which was nothing but a continuous drunk from whatever the hell time I got home on Friday to whatever time I passed out Sunday night. And then up early Monday morning and on off to Milwaukee to work. I was 23 years old at that time, young, healthy, strong, full of that pep and vigor that comes with youth. Every Monday was hell. You'd wake up feeling like 10 dead dogs, you know. But by the time you get up on the scaffold and get out in the air and you do a little work and you breathe in the ozone a little bit and the milkman shows up at about 10 o'clock, you get a couple of pints of cold milk to cool off the coppers, then you're all right. By 4:30, you're ready to go out and hit them again, you know. And that was sort of my pattern. If I was an alcoholic then, I don't really identify because it really wasn't an alcoholic type drinking that I was doing. It was a very heavy, heavy drinking. I drank almost every night, but not drunk every night. I'm the kind of a drinker. I was never a lounge drinker or a cocktail place drinker. I don't know too much about that. I'm a neat drinker. I drank it straight, you know. Whether you had wash or not didn't make much difference to me because I liked the taste of it. I was always interested in the size of the shot. That was about the thing that bothered me. And I hung out in men's places, you know, where you'd buy three and you get one kick back, where you talk about the fights, the ball games, the girls, and crap like that. And that was the kind of drinking I'd done. And this one particular Monday morning, a new thing was to take place in my life that I hadn't been aware of. At 23, I knew nothing about alcohol or alcoholism or AA or, you know, I just thought drinking was part of the game, you know, part of the game. And I got ready to leave home, and I got a little bit of a clue right off the bat when I left the house. Because my car was parked right in front of the house, well, a pickup truck, actually. And I walked out to step down off the curb to get over to my car. Now, I have built curbing all over the United States. And I know it's 9.5 inches, because that's the code in the Midwest. But I swear to Christ, that morning when I stepped off of that curb, it was 9 feet to the road. I thought I'd never hit the road, you know. It was out of proportion. And I got into my car to drive. And cars that were actually, you know, 3 or 4 intersections ahead of me seemed to be right on top of me. Just everything was out of proportion. And I took a shortcut through the country, and I was on a country road, and a nausea sort of came over me. And I pulled over to the side of the road, figuring, well, I'll have a smoke, listen to the radio, and this will pass. I had never experienced a dry heaves in my life up until that morning. Now, there's nothing dramatic about the dry heaves to you and I, you know, we're the pros. You know, for you maybe who don't know what that is, that's like being seasick when you have lockjaw, you know. And I pulled over to the side of the road to I thought, throw up. But Jesus, I went through all of that hell and that torment, and you know exactly what I'm talking. And I come up with a blank, you know, come up with a nothing happened. And it scared the living hell out of me. Scared me to death. I began thinking weird things like alcoholics do, you know. Maybe I've got polio of the teeth or something. I thought I was going to die. Now, think back in your own drinking career. At the height of your drinking career or in the throes of your drinking career, whenever you thought you were going to die, where did you go? Did you go to a doctor? Did you go to a hospital? Hell no, you went to that same asshole bartender that I went to, you know. We have put more faith in bartenders, for Christ's sake, than we have in presidents, you know. And I didn't know what in the hell to do. Now, the first town I was to come to was a place called Rochelle, Illinois, and I had built a high school there, so I had done a lot of drinking there. But I had done that kind of drinking, you guys know what I'm talking about. You come in at 4:30 after work, you throw the bucket up on the bar, you're matching quarters for the jukebox, everybody shaking dice for drinks, talking about the fights, the ball games, just raising all sorts of hell. Relaxing, we used to call it, you know, relaxing. And so I went right away, you know, almost automatically to that same tavern. Now, up until that time, I had never been in a tavern in my life, you know, in the morning, a weekday morning. I had many Saturdays and Sundays, you know, but never on a work day. And I got a surprise soon as I walked in there because it was about 7:15. And I opened up the door and it was just as crowded then as it had been at 4:30. And I just didn't understand that. Now, it wasn't the taking up with a bunch of the guys that I drank with at 4:30. This was sort of a new bunch, you know. And it was awful quiet. There was nobody playing the jukebox. I'm quite sure it wasn't even plugged in, to tell you the truth. Nobody was talking about ball games or girls, and certainly nobody was slamming them dice boxes down on his up. They had done that. Five guys would have went straight up, you know. They were doing that weird kind of drinking that you and I come to know so well, you know. It's almost a struggle where the drink is before you, you know, and it's a battle between you and that drink. And I guess all of these people, I'm not qualified to diagnose it, but I imagine based on what I see, you know, what do they always say? If you walk like a duck and you talk like a duck and you got feathers, it's a pretty good chance you're a duck, you know? And that's how it was with these people. And I was only about 10 seconds away from becoming one of them, and I didn't realize that. Because I told Fritzy, the bartender, a guy I knew very well, I told him about my experience on the country road, how I tried to throw up and I couldn't, and I ordered a Broma Seltzer. Now, let me tell you about these educated bartenders. You know what Fritzy said to me in a very classic moment of seriousness and compassion? He said, Duff, I hate to see you get hooked on them. And I says, what am I going to have? I think I'm going to die. He says, have one of the specials. Well, a special in the kind of joint I drank in was a double shot of bar whiskey and a kicker of beer on the side for $0.50. And so he threw one up there, and I let that thing fly, and in it went. And I let it settle and go down there and ding-dong and come halfway back up and then just sort of smooth itself out. And I felt good. I got well. The only lesson I learned from that was now I could drink more. So long as I could come in here Monday mornings, hit one of them specials, I had it made. And I did that for about 2 months. For about 8 weeks, I'd run in there every Monday morning, In this special, in Blue Moon, I'd stand there and I'd get well, go out and hop in my little pickup truck and off I'd go. And it was inevitable, as you know, that the day was to come when I walked in there, they poured that double shot, they threw up that kicker of beer, and I whipped it in there, and I stood there to get well. And I stood there, and I stood there, and I stood there, and I didn't get well. And I had to ask the inevitable question. Fritzy, what the hell is the matter? I'm not well. And you all know what he said. You need another. Then it took two, then three, then four, and then five. Then I became a financial wizard, thought that was getting expensive buying all them 50-cent shots. Why don't I just buy a half a pint? I can keep that in the glove compartment, and that'll last me for 2 Mondays. Didn't last me the first Monday. Then it became a pint, and then inevitably, you know, and I see you shaking your hands in the scent, you know. Eventually, I didn't get to work. I didn't get to work. Does alcohol interfere with your life? Is your life becoming unmanageable? If that's the clue, then there I was. I was with you. Shortly after that, the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my entire life happened. One of the little bricklayers that had working for me, a kid by the name of Eddie Friel, who used to be a drunk. He was a pain in the ass, you know. I used to hate to see him around. I fired him a million times, but I thought he had taken some kind of a thing with the church because he didn't drink anymore. And I was glad of that. Because before that, I was always having to pay him off, or finance companies were on the job garnishing his pay. We used to have to hide his pickup truck from the finance guys, and Eddie would go uptown for lunch and never come back for a week, you know. And they used to drive me crazy, you know. But now he hadn't had a drink for a couple of years, and I sort of liked that. And I never knew that he was the messenger that God had selected in my case, you know. Because he walked up to me on the scaffold one Tuesday morning and said the goddamnedest thing I ever heard in my life. He had the audacity to walk up to me and he said, "Hey, Boomer," he said, "I want to tell you something." I said, "What's that, Ed?" He says, "I'm an alcoholic," and he says, "I belong to AA. Would you like to go to a meeting?" My first reaction was almost automatic, you know. I reached for something. If I could have got my hands on a 2x4, I would have put it up aside of his head, you know, and broke his face because I was humiliated. This guy calling me an alcoholic. When we talk about the spiritual things that take place in our lives. Now, I know that the spiritual awakening can only come about as a result of the first 11 steps. But I believe spiritual things take place in our arrival in AA. We talk about that as saying divinely guided, because there's so many things that have taken place in our lives that defy any kind of logic. Because my answer to, "Would you like to go to a meeting?" was, "Don't you ever say that again or I'll punch you right in the mouth." That's what I started to say. But what came out was, "When is it?" You've done that. Now, something happened at that first meeting. There was an iron worker foreman by the name of McGinnis, worked for American Bridge and Iron. And Muggs and I, from the day we were born, had a personality clash. It just seems that we could never be within 100 miles of each other without getting in the fight. It was almost a legend, you know, in the construction field in the Middle West about McGinnis and Duffy. Well, let them have their fight and get it over with, you know. And because every place we went, we got in the fight. And I remember walking into that first AA meeting. It was a speaker-type meeting. And like so many new people, I didn't pay too much attention to what they were saying. I was looking around to see if I knew anybody there. And the only one I knew was Muggs. And there he was sitting up there in about the second or third row, you know. And Muggs was about 8 years older than me. And he had a face that looked like an alcoholic, too, you know. And when the meeting broke up, as we started to leave the hall, I noticed McGinnis standing out there by the door, out by the street, where I had to walk out. And my only thought was, "Jesus Christ, not here. Do we have to do it here, too, you know?" I had a suit on, a tie. But as I got up to Muggs, all he said to me, he says, "Well, hotshot," he says, "how'd you like that meeting?" And my only snotty answer that's capable of people who are filled with denial, you know, was what any decent alcoholic would say. I'd say, "It's a great place for assholes like you, Muggs." And I got ready, you know. But he didn't make any move, and then he said something to me. He says, "I figured you'd say that." He said, "Go on out and get yourself a story." And he says, "If you don't die or go mad, come on back." And that was the first time I ever did what I was told in AA. Because I was only 24 years old that night, and the next 6 years I went out there and made a lot of them guys sound like they had done their drinking in Disneyland, you know. I went out and got myself a story. And I certainly would not stand here, you know, for the rest of this meeting and embarrass and bore you by giving you a blow-by-blow description of everything that happened to me. I could stand here and tell you about prisons and jails and institutions and straitjackets and all of that stuff that's common to people like you and I who persist in an illusion that somehow, someway, we can drink like so-called normal people. Normal. That always, that sends chills up and down me every time I say that. Let me tell you how I feel about that. Normal people. Before you laugh, hold it. Just let me tell you how I feel. And I don't like to throw a damper on your party here, but you know, this is a life and death deal. Let's not kid ourselves. Everybody in this hall tonight is not finished drinking. Our experience and your experience tells us that there are people here tonight that are going to drink again. And I certainly number myself amongst those possibilities. A lady over here is looking at me with daggers. Honey, I didn't originate those words. They're in this book. And if you don't know where they're in the book, you know, turn to the 5th chapter. Rather than that, I'll quote them for you. It says in that book, "Despite all that we can say, many who are real alcoholics, by every form of self-deception and experimentation, will try to prove themselves the exception to the rule." So you're here, whoever the hell you are. God bless you and Godspeed. We also say, if you can do that turnabout and drink like a man, our hats are off to you, because heaven knows we ourselves have tried hard enough and long enough. But think for a minute what people like you and I have to pay for a drink now as alcoholics. You know, it's no more taking out a couple of bucks and throwing it up there and saying, "Give me a double shot of VO, a little water on the side." Sure, they'll take the money, but you also got to throw your job up there, your family, your kids, your self-respect, everything you love dearly, your whole life. Because you and I don't have the power to predict the outcome of when we take a drink. We do not know what's going to happen to me. I was at a meeting just this week and I heard some jackass say, "Well, for me to drink again would be insane, because I know what's going to happen to me." Let there be no doubt in your mind, there's no mortal human being who walks the face of this earth that has the power to predict the outcome of any future event, let alone an alcoholic who's about to put into his or her system the number one mood-altering, personality-changing drug known to man. You do not know what's going to happen to you. Your presence at this meeting is valid proof of that. None of you intended to be here. But in its seriousness, though, in its seriousness, you know, we've got to put it all up on the line to become a normal drinker. That's what we're trying to do, be normal drinkers. Jeez, I get clammy thinking of that. The insidiousness of that, that attempt at trying to be a normal drinker, is almost unbelievable. Because there's not an alcoholic who walks the face of this earth who could tolerate for more than 2 seconds the conditions surrounding normal drinking. Or have you forgotten how normal drinkers drink? You know? They leave half of a drink on the bar and go home. They say the goddamnest thing. No thanks. How about I've had enough? Two's my limit. They put the cap back on bottle. They say, let's eat. Right, that's frightening. People trying to be normal drinkers. I watched some not too long ago in the airport. Yeah. I tell you, I know I'm sick. I know that because I'm obsessed with alcohol, you know. I love alcohol. I love the taste of it, the color of it, the shape of the bottles. I love where you gotta go to get it. But it's not for me. I was waiting in the dining room, you know, waiting to get a table, and they're pulling that crap, so we had to go up to the bar and stand there and get a drink. And right alongside of where I was standing was the cutest little round table I've ever seen in my life. Cute little tiny little red and black thing, you know. Looked like something my mother would put a fern on, you know. Cute little thing. Little cardboard said happy hour on it. And a couple of young kids came over and sat down there, about 23. A couple of them skinny ass skier types, you know. And they sat down there, and I just thought I was watching them. I don't know, she was a rather attractive girl. And then the guy, I liked him right off the bat. Because I don't know what the hell it was, I didn't hear that, or what the name was, but whatever the hell it was, it came in the biggest damn glass I ever seen in my life, you know. Looked like a candy dish, you know. And it had all sorts of things in it, you know. It had olive in it, had an onion in it, and a dead fish was in there. It was like a Christmas stocking almost. Yeah, a whole lot of little things. And I got wrapped up watching them, you know. And the waitress put them down, and boy, you know, I'm ready to, let's go. Yeah. And they talked. And I watched them, you know, for a while. Then they started hitting them olives with the toothpick. She finally ate her fish. My sponsor was with me, you know, and he said it really wasn't as long as I thought. I thought it was about an hour and a half. Probably 2 seconds, you know. I almost said, for Christ's sake, drink that, will you? Because, you know, if you can drink, you should be drinking, you know. Never mind this crap, you know. Let me tell you how I was coming from Atlanta, and I really got in a mess here. With a guy from Texas, by the way, Jim. Got on a plane at 10 minutes to 7. And zoom, off it goes. We're not in the air 5 minutes, so it's not even 7 o'clock yet. And here comes, you know, come fly with me down the aisle with our little car. And she said something to me that I used to pray people would say to me when I was drinking, you know. She said, would you like a drink? 5 to 7 in the morning. I says, no thanks. I says, I'd like some coffee with sugar, though. She says, fine. Now, the guy sitting by the window was a big monster of a guy, you know. I wear the big Texas hats on, big buckle on here, you know. And she said, would you like a drink? And he paused and he thought for a minute, and he sort of eyed my coffee, and he said, I'll have some coffee with sugar also. My sick, twisted mind. Right away, I figured this guy's on AA. Why not? So I'm going to play it cool, of course, you know. I'm not going to blow any of the traditions. She hands me his coffee to give to him, and I reached over and I looked him square in the eye, and I said, easy does it. And he sort of looked at me strange, you know. He said, you trying to tell me something? I said, we belong to the same club. He said, what club is that? AA. Holy Christ. He went up like a rocket. He hit his head on that luggage thing over there. Boom! And everybody in the damn plane heard him, you know, in that Texas drawl. He yelled out, "God damn! You all think I'm an alcoholic?" And I said to him, "Well, you're drinking coffee." He said, "I like coffee." I said, "But you could have a drink instead of that." He says, "I don't want a drink." I said, "Go ahead. If you're not an alcoholic, you can have one." He said, "I'd rather have the coffee." I said, "There's something wrong with you, because if I wasn't an alcoholic, I'd have a whole lot of drinks, you know." And that's always been my problem, you know. I get totally obsessed by things. And we were talking this afternoon, you know, over in the coffee shop. I hope that guy is here, that kid, you know. Oh, I can't tell. Too many of you here. I was listening. These guys were sitting in the booth behind me, and they were talking. And I'm a nosy old guy. And I guess he just had a discussion meeting or something here last night in their room or something. And they were talking about the steps of this program and how difficult they are. And I'm sort of sitting there with that old-timer smirk on my face, you know. And they came to an opinion that I want to smash all the hell tonight. That the toughest step in this program is the fourth step. Now, the fourth step, for those of you who may be new, makes mention of the fact that we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And people say that's hard to do. And there's a lot of people in AA said that we lose a lot of people when they reach that plateau. In other words, newcomers are quick to take the first three steps because those steps you receive a lot. And the fourth step is the first time you're asked to do something, and that's when a lot of people bail out. But the fourth step, my God, I wonder how many of you realize that you took the fourth step before you ever came to AA. You don't get to AA until you take the fourth step. That's what brought you here. Somewhere, sometime, someplace back there in your drinking career. Whether it was in your own home or a gutter or a skid row or a jail cell or a hospital ward, somewhere you took a look at your life up to this time. And obviously you didn't like what the hell you saw. And you must have said, "I think I'll do something about this. I'm going to join AA." That's all the step is all about. These steps are the simplest things in the world, unless you're an alcoholic. In my opinion, the steps will be difficult only if your desire to drink is still stronger than your desire to not drink. And as long as it stays that way, they will always be difficult. No matter how long you are around here. But just as soon as your desire to not drink becomes a little bit stronger than your desire to drink, then the simplicity of this program makes its appearance. And you sit back and you look at them steps and say, "Jesus Christ, why were they so difficult? How about steps 1, 2, and 3? Big deal? You took them before you got here. You took them more than you took any other steps. And you usually took them in the morning with your head resting on the porcelain, you know? And you're looking at those great words in AA, American Standard, you know? And you're trying to throw up, and you can't throw up. Every nerve and every muscle in your body is about ready to leap right out of your skin, you know. And you're freezing to death, and you're sweating, and you feel like you got the weight of the world on your shoulders, and Christ, you... "Oh, good God, I can't get off of this son of a bitch. It's driving me out of my goddamn mind. I'm going crazy. Good, I'd do anything to get over this. For Christ's sake, God help me." That's step 1, 2... No big deal. No big deal. Hey, step 5. You've told every bartender in North and West Territory your story, for Christ's sake. What's the matter with telling it to somebody else? So don't make a big deal out of these steps. Don't stand there fighting these things, because if you're going to fight them, you're going to lose. Cemetery is full of guys like that, full of people who've lost. And then how about that action? People say, well, geez, I go to meetings every night in the week. I can't understand. AA don't work for me. AA don't work for you if you don't get into AA. How often have we heard it, you know? Not around it, in it. And a lot of people don't understand what the hell we're talking about. It's easy if you think of it this way, especially if you're native to the great West here, you know. Remember how the West was settled? That's a good example of in it or on it. You know, them pioneers from way back came out here, you know, in them big wagon train things, you know, from awful places like Cincinnati and Ohio and things like that. Think about that. They'd get together back there in Cincinnati. Most of them were getting run out of town anyhow, you know, they had to make a move. And so somebody says, let's go to Oregon. And yeah, let's go. About 500 people decide to come to Oregon, and then all of a sudden it dawns on them, nobody knows how to get here. So they said, well, we need somebody to take us. So they look up in the yellow pages and says, wagon masters, you know, Ward Bond. And they give old Ward a call, you know, and Ward says, yeah, I'll take you out there to Oregon on the Oregon Trail. Meet me Monday morning down in the town square, have all your gear together, and I want you all sign a waiver that I run the whole show. So they get down there Monday morning, and they got all the wagons together, you know, and the pots and pans, and a couple old steers, and they all sign the damn waivers, you know, and Ward gets ready to start them off. He got old Frankie Lane there with him to give him a, whoa, you know, that kind of crap. They go, oh, and boom, off they go, you know. Clippity-clop, and they go through Ohio and Illinois, clippity-clop through Iowa and Nebraska, clip-clop, Wyoming, you know, and Utah, clip-clop. Long time. And finally, they come to Nevada, up around Winnemucca someplace. And old Ward holding council there one night says, well, folks, now we over here in Nevada, gotta watch our step. This is bad country over here. A lot of Indians around here, a lot of bad people. So starting tonight, when we stop for the day, I want you to put the wagons in a circle. And every one of you that wants some degree of protection, get in the circle. So that night, clippity-clop, they come to a stop and they put the wagons in a big circle. And everybody gets inside the circle. And then dusk comes to the desert, you know. The whippoorwill's whipper, you know. Antelope play. The purple sage. And it looks so peaceful there in the wagon train. And then all of a sudden some guy lights up a cigarette. And Ward hollers up, pack a goddamn cigarette! Can see it 7 miles from here! Guy says, screw you, Ward, I want to smoke! Ward says, get the hell out of the circle then! This guy packs his gear, goes down the road a couple of hundred yards, pitches up his little sleeping bag, lights up a joint and says, there, screw you, Ward. Then night comes back to the den. The whippoorwill whipper and the antelope play. And it looks so nice. And then all of a sudden somebody starts playing the banjo. Ward says, knock off that banjo. Screw you, Ward, I want to play my banjo. Then get the hell out of the circle. And down the road he goes to play his banjo. Pretty soon Ward says, hey, none of that kind of crap over here. You two get the hell out of the circle, you know? And down the road they go. And night comes back to the desert. Whippoorwill's whipper. Antelope play. And it looks so nice. There's the circle. Everybody's inside the circle except them out there. And it looks again like a Hallmark greeting card of a Western scene. Early America. And then you look up on the mesa. And up there in their pintos is Cochise and Sitting Bull. And they looking down there at that wagon train, you know. Cochise says to Sitting Bull, "Hey, Bull." Bull says, "What do you want, Cole?" He says, "That looks like one of Ward Bond's wagon trains." Bull says, "Yeah." He says, "He sort of outfoxed us again, put him in a circle." Cole says, "Yeah, we're going to go home empty-handed. It'd be a waste of time." He says, "Here we have been out for 3 days and haven't gotten anything. Let's take a ride over to Bighorn, see if that Custer's around." Guy says, "Yeah, hold it." He says, "Wait a minute, Bull." Bull says, What do you see, Cole?" He's looking at the guy way over there smoking a cigarette. Bull says, "Got him. Oh, yeah. Jesus, look at the guy with the banjo. Hey, look at them two over there." "Well, we don't have to go home empty-handed." And down off the mesa they come in their pinos. They get the guy with the cigarettes, the banjo, and a couple of lovers over there. They get all of the people that were around the circle. And the people in the circle are safe, and it's the exact same principle in this program. If being in the circle wasn't important, there wouldn't be a whole chapter in this book entitled Into Action or Working with Others. That's how important it is. If you're going to come into here and sit in the back row, throw your buck in and get the hell out of here before the Lord's Prayer, you're wasting your time. You're wasting your time, you know. Because it is inevitable that you will drink again. You will drink again. And then comes a time people say, "Is there a guarantee? Is there a guarantee?" Hell no, there's no guarantee, but there's something that's awful close to a guarantee in this book. I used to say that sponsorship was the most important part of AA. I still believe it's right up there in the top. Because in one of our earlier pamphlets, that little green and white one, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship, it used to say, sponsorship is the heart of the AA approach to recovery. Well, any fool knows that the heart is the most vital organ there is. The message I get from that statement is that without sponsorship, you die. Without your heart, you're done. But like so many other things, as you keep reading this book over and over again and referring to it over and over again, or you listen one night at a meeting and you're listening better than before, you hear the message loud and clear. And it was read here tonight, and I'm quite sure it's read at most of your meetings here in this area, as it is all over the United States. It's the second and third of the three pertinent ideas at that portion of the fifth chapter that we read at this meeting. A very clear and definite statement. First, we must recall who wrote this book. You know, the Pope didn't write this book, or Ernest Hemingway, or James Michener, or Walt Disney. This book was written by you and I. People just like you and I wrote this book. If we could turn the clock back about 48 years right now, take quite a few of you out of here, just leave 100 of you in here, you would be the people who wrote this book. And amongst you are the same kind of people that were there then, atheists, agnostics, believers, non-believers, rich, poor, white, black, red, dumb, stupid, smart, intelligent, the cosmopolitan makeup of Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything in this book, it was agreed upon, would be unanimous, not by majority. In other words, they said nothing would go in this book unless the entire group was in accord. Now, trying to get 100 alcoholics to agree on one thing, you'd think would be a tremendous task, because I imagine your committee members here could tell you that it's difficult getting two to agree on something. But yet again, defying logic, divinely guided, these men and women agreed. Even the atheists and even the agnostics. And the second of those three pertinent ideas says this: we believed that no human power could relieve our alcoholism. Well, that eliminates Bill and Bob, eliminates my sponsor, my doctor, my counselor, me. Then pray tell, if no human power can relieve my alcoholism, then who can? Any of you who are students of the English language know what a definite is. A definite is a word that carries a single message just in the pronouncing of the word, and it goes beyond guarantee and theory. It's fact. The third pertinent idea says this very definitely. But God, and they call them God, they didn't call them a chair, they didn't call them a tree or a stone or a post. They said God. They said, but God could, and that's a definite statement, could and would. That's another definite statement. So they told you the answer is here, could and would, and then they put it right back on your lap. If you choose. Not if we choose, not if we decide, if you decide. If you want what we have, then here is what we did. It's that simple. It's as simple as asking a guy, how do I get out of the woods? And he says, well, I live in them, so I know the shortest way. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has followed them kind of guys. You come in here and you say, I want to get sober, how do I do it? And you tell them. But we can't handle that, can we? That's too damn simple. It's just like two guys arriving in San Francisco. Never been there before in their lives. One's an alcoholic, one's a social drinker. They come out of the Greyhound bus depot on 7th Street, right in front of the main post office. They want to know how to get up to the Sir Francis Drake Hotel. So they walk up to a guy selling newspapers there at the newsstand. They say, hey, how do I get to the Sir Francis Drake Hotel? That's the social drinker asking them. News guy says, walk up to the corner. That's Market Street. Turn right on Market Street, go down 2.5 blocks, and you'll be in front of the Emporium department store. When you're standing in front of the Emporium, look across the street and you'll see Woolworths and you'll see the cable car turn around. That's Powell Street. Cross over there and at the foot of Powell Street, start walking up the hill. First you'll cross over O'Farrell, then you'll cross over Geary, you'll go past St. Francis Hotel, Union Square, you'll cross over Post Street and you start up Powell Street and the first block up the hill is Sutter. On the corner of Powell and Sutter is the Sir Francis Drake Hotel. You gotta say, thanks a lot, that's swell. And off he goes. Then the alcoholic comes out. He asks the same question, gets the same directions, and he starts walking up towards Market Street and he begins to think. And you know we're not supposed to do that. And his first thought is, I suppose that newspaper guy thinks I'm a dumb asshole. If he knew anything, he wouldn't be selling newspapers. By the time you get up to Market Street, you turn left. You go clear out to Van Ness. Get out to Van Ness, you turn right and go 18 blocks to Bay Street. You get to Bay Street and you turn right and you go down past Giardelli Square and the Cannery, down into North Beach and you get to Columbus. On Columbus, you make a half right and go on up into Italian Town. You hit Stockton, you turn on Stockton a half right and you go through Chinatown, through the Stockton Street Tunnel. And you come out on the corner of Stockton and Sutter. You turn right on Sutter, go up 2 blocks, and you're in front of the Sir Francis Drake Hotel. 3 years later. So the time finally came in my life, and I believe I mentioned it here last year when I said I had to face that dilemma. You know, it says in our literature, someplace in our literature, that generally a dilemma will precede our decision. Our decision as to whether to continue on in our madness or reach out for the recovery. A dilemma is a hell of a time, a hell of a time. It's a confusing time. My dilemma and your dilemma was probably the same, only in different places. A dilemma was best defined to me once as a thing that you have opposite answers for the same question, and both answers are valid. Now, it sounds screwy, but the more I thought about it, the more I reflected back in my drinking career, I knew exactly what they were talking about. Because that time came in my life when I faced my dilemma, when I had to make my decision whether to go on with the madness or reach out. And that took place in a bar called Big Rothschild's on West Madison Street in Chicago, Illinois. I had relegated myself to an animal, you know. My life now is only 20-minute intervals. That's all I gave a damn about. When would I get my next drink? Could I sell my blood today? And that was it, you know. And I remember going into Rothschild's one morning, and you've been there. You know exactly what I'm talking about. You get that damn drink, and it's right there in front of you, you know, and you look at it, you know. And you know damn well that it's killing you. You know that. Me and you knew that long before anybody else. You look at that damn drink, you know, and you're crying because you're so ashamed of what you've done to yourself. But you look at it and you say, Jesus Christ, if I drink it, it's going to kill me. And you know it and believe it. But at the same time, something in the back of your head is saying, but if you don't drink it, you're going to die. And that's a dilemma. Because both answers are valid. If I drink it, it kills me, and if I don't drink it, I die. And the only salvation from that is to reach out and call upon a power greater than ourselves. Call God. I had some trouble with that, but finally through that moment of clarity they talk about, I was given sort of a reprieve, that daily reprieve they talked about, and I found a relationship between God as I understand him and my late father. I loved my father. I loved my father more than I've loved anything in my entire life. My father was the greatest thing in my life. My father was just everything that I ever would have ever wanted to be. Just one fraction of what he could have been. My father was a tremendous man to me. In the eyes of the law agencies in the state of New York and a district attorney by the name of Tom Dewey, my father was a criminal, and he had to pay a hell of a price for that, a hell of a price. But for the people of New York, my father was more of a Robin Hood than he ever was a criminal. But the law was the law. And I loved this man because he knew everything, and I can remember how whenever I would question my father about anything, he always had an answer. And being born and raised in the kind of neighborhood that I was born and raised in New York was predominantly an Italian neighborhood. And when you got a name like Duffy, you got to know you got to wake up every morning ready to fight if you live in that kind of a neighborhood. And them little wops was kicking the hell out of me every goddamn day, except Sunday. Because on Sunday, my father would come and get me, and he'd take me to the Elks Club with him. And I can remember that so well. I'd hold his hand, and his hand was bigger than me. And we'd walk right through that little Italian town, you know, and them little guineas would look at me, you know. And they wouldn't dare come near me as long as I was holding on to my father's hand. And my father knew everybody, and he loved life. God, he loved life. And he didn't laugh, he roared. And he always wore a derby. And he knew everybody, and they knew him. And the guy in the vegetable store would give him a bag of apples. The guy in the bakery would give him bread. And fishermen had given, always given him things because of the lots of things he'd done for them. And oh, he was such a great guy, you know. And that's how I see God now, because one night at a meeting when I was trying to figure out who the hell is God, you know, we closed the meeting and we said, Our Father, Our Father. So I want to tell you how lucky I am, and not in any way am I trying to portray the image of God as my Father. It's just my unique way. I, as you, talk to God twice a day, at least, every morning and every night. And I'll talk to God tonight sometime before I go to sleep. And I'm so lucky, because when I talk to God, I'm talking to my Father. And I sit there with my Father, and I see my Father, and I see the derby, and I see the black hair coming out of his T-shirt up here. And I hear that same roar that I heard as a little kid. And I feel him when he crushes me close to him. And that's how I talk to God, as though I was talking to my father. I never lied to my father in my life. Not for any moral reasons, more out of fear, I guess, than anything else. So I wouldn't lie to God. And I accepted the truth from my father as I accepted from God. I know my father was probably putting out a bunch of bullshit, but God isn't. And so it's great for me to have that relationship. Because God has been and always will be my answer. But until that time, I had an awful time getting back to God because I was ashamed of who I was and what I had become, just as many of you are ashamed of who you are and what you've become. You talked so much about God, and here I held a fear. I held a fear that if God knew I was amongst you, he'd come down here and damn me, and he'd strike me with a sword and say, get out of here, you know, because I had been a crud, I'd been a sleaze bag, and I had been a scumhead, you know. I've done things that I'm so ashamed of that I hesitate sometimes to even tell them. But they've happened, you know, they've happened. They're part of that time. But when it came time that I had to reach out for God, I was so blessed because I recalled an incident that I had heard in my life, you know, about farmers, you know, farmers in Georgia, a sharecropping family in Georgia. And if you've ever been in Georgia, you know what a horrible place that must be, to have to make a living out of the soil, because it's nothing but red clay in Georgia. And these people didn't do anything more than just make a living out of the soil. They had none of the luxuries and the things that you and I take for granted, you know, almost on a daily basis. They would get enough each year out of the ground to pay for whatever the hell needs they had for another year, another soil, another seed, and that was it. And then one year, as it was to become, after everything was bought and paid for, and the bills were taken care of, and the harvest was in, they discovered they had $5 left over. So out of joy, you know, and being wise, knowing that $5 was not enough to buy every member of the family a gift, they wisely decided to take the $5 and buy just one gift that the entire family could share in. And they decided to buy a mirror. This family had never owned a mirror. No one in this family had ever seen his or her own true self. They all knew the beauty in each other, but no one had ever seen his or her own image. So it was a banner day, of course, the day that the mirror arrived. And they gathered in the kitchen around the kitchen table, and out of respect, they let the father, as the head of the family, open the package and look into the mirror for the first time. Now, he knew the beauty in his wife, and he knew the beauty in his daughter and his little son. So when he looked into the mirror for the first time and saw himself, he did exactly what mature elderly men would do. He blushed, you know, and he gave his nose a couple of pokes and fooled with the strap on his overall and sort of blushed and smiled a bit, you know. And then he turned and he handed the mirror to his wife, who knew the beauty of her husband and of her children. And like a mature lady, she did exactly what mature ladies would do. She also blushed and smiled and fooled with her specs and primped the back of her hair and tasseled with the collar on her house coat, you know, and then just smiled and handed the mirror to her teenage daughter, who was a beautiful girl, who knew the beauty of her parents and of her little brother. And she did exactly what teenage girls would do. She pulled on her curls and fooled with the ribbon and giggled and blushed and giggled some more. And then she turned and she handed the mirror to her little 7-year-old brother, who knew all of the beauty in her family. Now, her little brother, when he had only been 1 year old, had been standing alongside of his daddy while his daddy was milking a cow. And the cow had kicked out and struck this little boy in the face. And what was supposed to have been a little child's face was nothing but twisted, ugly, ghoulish flesh. It was grotesque. And when that innocent little child looked into that mirror and saw that ugliness that represented his face, he was so confused, so confused. And like any confused little boy, he went immediately to his mother. And half crying and full of tears, he says, "Mama, why am I this ugly? Have I always been this ugly?" And she said, "No, you haven't always been that ugly." He said, "But Mama, how can you love me when I'm so ugly?" And she said, "Because you're mine." And that's the relationship that I have with God as I understand him now. He, besides myself, is the only other person who has known me in my complete and my total ugliness. When my family justifiably had to turn away from me because of my ugliness, when my friends also justifiably had to turn away because of my ugliness, I stood perhaps as you stood once. My back was to the wall. And I called upon God for some help, and God says God could and would if he was saw. And I sought this God as directed through prayer and through meditation. And I wouldn't be that egotistical to think for one moment that God himself came down to handle me. But he went out there amongst you, and he selected one of you just as he selected somebody for you. And he chose a man to be his instrument. The instrument to carry to me recovery. And God, without any words of condemnation, without any damnation at all, did all of this. And he brought me here to you. And by using you as his miracle, he created my own miracle of recovery. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. God bless you and thank you.